Welcome to VMN Volume 5, Episode 2. The date is July 4th, 2026. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Oh, what the fuck am I doing with this polished intro? This is the motherfucking 4th of July, and I'm expressing my disgust and giving a platform to others. I hope this all will make you think or feel less alone on this particular colonizer day. Well, the 4th of July, yeah, when I was young, I used to really like the little sparkly things in the sky, but things have kind of changed over the years. You know, I live in rural areas, and what the 4th of July means is I gotta hide. You know, there's gonna be drunk people on the streets. People feel empowered to mess with people that they see as less than. So when I'm on the road, I gotta be really careful for people coming at me or doing something stupid, driving their car towards me. And God help me if I go into towns, because people are going to be assholes. They feel these holidays make them feel like they can do stuff, that they can act better than. And I just don't really like that. You know, it's really scary. And I hold a lot of privileges, so I don't see what a lot of people see, and it's bad for me. You know, I'm queer, I'm obviously quite poor, and a neurodivergent is obvious with me. So I get a lot of shit in these towns and on the roads. And, you know, sometimes you have ATVs or trucks with flags, and these are dangerous. You know, they will mess with you. It seems like when people fly a flag, it's going to say they're going to mess with people. I don't really like that. But there's people who can say things a lot better than me. Now we'll shut up and read the words of someone who expressed this far better than I did back in 1852. Well, this is The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro by Frederick Douglass. It's abridged. It's from Massachusetts Humanities. Frederick Douglass, July 5th, 1852. Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, the task before me is one which requires much previous thought and study for its proper performance. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before any assembly more shrinkingly nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. The papers and placards say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight. That I am here today, to me, a matter of astonishment as well as gratitude. This, for the purpose of the celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to the day and to the act of your great deliverance. This celebration also marks the beginning of another year of your national life, and reminds you that the Republic of America is now 76 years old. I am glad, fellow citizens, that your nation is so young. You are, even now, only in the beginning of your national career, still lingering in the period of childhood. I repeat, I am so glad that this is so. There is hope in the thought, and hope is much needed under the dark clouds which lower above the horizon. Fellow citizens, 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects. The style and title of your sovereign people, in which you now glory, was not then born. You are under the British crown. Your fathers esteemed the English government as the home government, England as the fatherland, although a considerable distance from your home, imposed in the exercise of its parental prerogatives upon its colonial children, such restraints, burdens, and limitations as its mature judgment it deemed wise, right, and proper. But your fathers, who had not adopted the idea of infallibility of government and the absolute character of his acts, presumed to differ from the home government in respect to the wisdom and the justice of some of these burdens and restraints. They went so far as to pronounce the measures of the government unjust, unreasonable, and oppressive, and altogether such as ought not to be quietly submitted to. I scarcely need to say, fellow citizens, that my opinion of these measures fully accords with that of your fathers. Feeling themselves harshly and unjustly treated by the home government, your fathers, like men of honesty and men of spirit, earnestly sought redress. They petitioned and remonstrated. They did so in a decorous, respectful, and loyal manner. This, however, did not answer the purpose. They saw themselves treated with sovereign indifference, coldness, and scorn. Yet they persevered. Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers became restive under this treatment. They felt themselves victims of grievous wrongs, wholly incurable in their colonial capacity. With brave men, there is always a remedy for oppression. Just here, the idea of total separation of the colonies from the crown was born. It was a startling idea, much more so than we, at the distance of time, regard it. The timid and the prudent of the day were, of course, shocked and alarmed by it. Their opposition to the then dangerous thought was earnest and powerful. But amid all their terror and affrighted vociferations against it, the alarming and revolutionary idea moved on, and the country with it. On the 2nd of July, 1776, the Old Continental Congress, to the dismay of the lovers of ease and the worshippers of property, clothed that dreadful idea with the authority of national sanction. They did so in the form of a resolution. We seldom hit upon resolutions drawn up in our day whose transparency is at all equal it. Resolved that these United Colonies are of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown. Citizens, your fathers made good that resolution. They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours, and you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary. The 4th of July is the first great fact in your nation's history, the very ringbolt in the chain of your yet undeveloped destiny. Pride and patriotism, no less than gratitude, prompt you to celebrate and hold it in perpetual remembrance. I have said that the Declaration of Independence is the ringbolt to the chain of your nation's destiny. So indeed I regard it. These principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by these principles. Be true to them on all occasions, in all places, and all foes, and at whatever cost. Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of this Declaration of Independence were brave men. I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes. And for the good they did and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. They love their country better than their own private interest, and all will concede that it is a rare virtue that ought to command respect. He who will intelligently lay down his life for his country is a man whom it is not human nature to despise. Your fathers staked their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor on the cause of their country. It is their admiration of liberty they lost sight of all other interest. They were peace men, but they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage. They were quiet men, but they did not shrink from agitating against oppression. They showed forbearance, but they knew its limits. They believed in order, but not in the order of tyranny. With them, nothing was settled. It was not right. With them, justice, liberty, and humanity were final, not slavery and oppression. You may well cherish the memory of such men. They were great in their day and generation. Their solid manhood stands out the more as we contrast it with these degenerate times. How circumspect, exact, and proportionate were their movements. How unlike the politicians of an hour. Their statesmanship looked beyond the passing moment and stretched away in strength into the distant future. Mark them, fully appreciating the hardship to be encountered. Firmly believing in the right of their cause, wisely measuring the terrible odds against them, your fathers and fathers in this republic laid the cornerstone of this the national superstructure, which has risen and still rises in grandeur around you. Of this fundamental work, This day is the anniversary. Our eyes are met with demonstrations of joyous enthusiasm. The cause which led to the separation of the colonies from the British crown have never lacked for a tongue. They have all been taught in your common schools, narrated at your firesides, unfolded from your pulpits, and thundered from your legislative halls, as are familiar to your household words. They form the staple of your national poetry and eloquence. I leave, therefore, the great deeds of your fathers to others. My business, if I have any here today, is with the present. The accepted time with God and his cause is the ever-living now. We have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future. Now is the time, the important time. Your fathers have lived, died, and have done their work, and have done much of it well. You live and must die, and you must do your work. You have no right to enjoy a child's share in the labor of your fathers unless your children are to be blessed by your labor. You have no right to wear out and waste the hard-earned fame of your fathers to cover your indolence. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called to speak here today? We have I, or those who I represent, to do your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of national justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions, then would my task be light and my burden easy and delightful. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not me. The sunlight which brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak this day? Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mourning wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I see this day from the slave's point of view. Standing here identified with the American bondsman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or the professions of the present, the conduct of this nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged in the name of liberty, which is fettered in the name of the Constitution and Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call into question and denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not heart a slaveholder, shall confess to be right and just. I fancy I hear one of my audience say, it is just in these circumstances that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain and there is nothing to be argued, what point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That the slaveholders acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government? They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia, which, if committed by a black man, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalty, the teaching of the slave to read or write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then I may consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your street, when the fowl of the air, when the cattle of your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, then I will argue with you that the slave is a man. It is not astonishing that while we are plowing, planting, and reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks and merchants and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manners of enterprise common to other men, digging gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God, and looking hopefully for life and or immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty, that he is the rightful owner of his own body? You've already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans to show that men have a natural right to freedom? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There's not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What? Am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations with their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with a lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, and to burn their flesh and starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employments for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What, then, remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? That God did not establish it? That our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason such a proposition? I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability, and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened, and the conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. Its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. You will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. Take the American slave trade, which we are told by the papers is especially preposterous just now, as the price of men was never higher and carried on in all the large towns and cities in one half of this Confederacy. This trade is one of the peculiarities of American institutions. In several states, this trade is a chief source of wealth. It is called the internal slave trade in order to divert from the horror which the foreign slave trade is contemplated. The foreign slave trade has long since been denounced by this government as piracy and as an execrable traffic. To arrest it, this nation keeps a squadron at immense cost on the coast of Africa. Everywhere in this country, it is safe to speak of this foreign slave trade as a most inhuman traffic, opposed alike to the laws of God and man. It is, however, a notable fact that while so much execration is poured out by Americans upon those engaged in the foreign slave trade, the men engaged in the slave trade between states pass without condemnation, and their business is deemed honorable. Behold the practical operation of this internal slave trade, the American slave trade sustained by American politics and American religion. Here you will see men and women reared like swine for the market. You know what is a swine driver? I will show you a man drover. They inhabit all our southern states. They perambulate the country and crowd the highways of the nation with droves of human stock. You'll see one of these human flesh jobbers armed with pistol, whip, and bowie knife, driving a company of 100 men, women, and children from the Potomac to the slave market at New Orleans. These wretched people are to be sold singly or in lot to suit purchasers. They are food for the cotton field and the deadly sugar mill. Mark the sad procession as it moves wearily along, and the inhuman wretch who drives them. Here is savage yells and blood-chilling oaths as he hurries on his affrighted captives. There see the old man with locks thin and gray. Cast one glance, if you please, upon that young mother whose shoulders are bare to the scorching sun, her briny tears falling on the brow of her babe in arms. See, too, that girl of 13 weeping, yes, weeping as she thinks of the mother form from whom she has been torn. The drove moves tardily. Heat and sorrow have nearly consumed their strength. Suddenly you hear a quick snap, like the discharge of a rifle. The fetters clank, and the chain rattles. Simultaneously, your ears are saluted with a scream that seems to have torn way to the center of your soul. The crack you heard was the sound of the slave whip. The scream you heard was from the woman you saw with the babe. Her speed has faltered under the weight of her child and her chains. That gash on her shoulder tells her to move on. Follow this drove to New Orleans. Attend the auction. See men examined like horses. See the form of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. See this drove sold and separated forever, and never forget the deep, sad sobs that arose from that scattered multitude. Tell me, citizens, where under the sun can you witness a spectacle more fiendish and shocking? Yet this is but a glance of the American slave trade as it exists at this moment in the ruling part of the United States. I was born amid such lights and scenes. To me, the American slave trade is a terrible reality. The fleshmongers gather up their victims by dozens and drive them chained to the General Depot at Baltimore. When a sufficient number has been collected here, a ship is chartered for the purpose of conveying the forlorn crew to Mobile or to New Orleans. From the slave prison to the ship, they are usually driven in the darkness of night. In the deep, still darkness of midnight, I have been often aroused by the dead, heavy footsteps and piteous cries of the chained gangs that passed our door. Fellow citizens, this murderous traffic is today in active operation in this boasted republic. In the solitude of my spirit, I see clouds of dust raised on the highways of the South. I see the bleeding footsteps. I see hear the doleful wail of fettered humanity on the way to slave markets, where the victims are to be sold like horses, sheep, and swine, knocked off to the highest bidder. There I see the tenderest ties ruthlessly broken to gratify the lust, caprice, and rapacity of the buyers and sellers of men. My soul sickens at the sight. But a still more inhuman, disgraceful, and scandalous state of things remains to be presented. By an act of American Congress, not yet 2 years old, slavery has been nationalized in its most horrible and revolting form. The Mason and Dixon's line has been obliterated. New York has become as Virginia, and the power to hold, hunt, and sell men, women, and children as slaves remains no longer a mere state institution, but now an institution of the whole United States. This power is coextensive with the Star-Spangled Banner and American Christianity. Where these go, may also go the merciless slave hunter. Where these are, man is not sacred. He is a bird for the sportsman's gun. By that most foul and fiendish of all human decrees, the liberty and person of every man are put in peril. Your broad Republican domain is a hunting ground for men. Your lawmakers have commanded all good citizens to engage in this hellish sport. Your president, your secretary of state, enforce as a duty you owe to your free and glorious country and to your God that you do this accursed thing. Not fewer than 40 Americans have, within the past 2 years, been hunted down and without a moment's warning hurried away in chains and consigned to slavery and excruciating torture. Some of these had wives and children, dependent on them for blood, but of this no account was made. The right of the hunter to his prey stands superior to the right of marriage and to all rights in this republic, the rights of God included. For black men there is neither law nor justice, humanity nor religion. The fugitive slave law makes mercy to them a crime, and bribes the judge who tries them. An American judge gets $10 for every victim he consigns to slavery, and $5 when he fails to do so. The oath of any two villains is sufficient, under this hell-black enactment, to send the most pious and exemplary black man into the remorseless jaws of slavery. His own testimony is nothing. He can bring no witness for himself. The minister of American justice is bound by the law to hear but one side, and that side is the side of the oppressor. Let this damning fact be perpetually told. Let it be thundered around the world that in tyrant-killing, king-hating, people-loving, democratic Christian America, the seats of justice are filled with judges who hold their office under an open and palpable bribe and are bound in deciding the case of a man's liberty to only hear his accusers. In glaring violation of justice, in shameless disregard of the forms of administering law, in cunning arrangement to entrap the defenseless, and in diabolical intent, this fugitive slave law stands alone in the annals of tyrannical legislation. Americans, your Republican politics, not less than your Republican religion, are flagrantly inconsistent. You boast of your love of liberty, your superior civilization, your pure Christianity, while the whole political power of the nation is solemnly pledged to support and perpetuate the enslavement of 3 millions of your countrymen. You hurl your anathemas at the crowned-headed tyrants of Russia and Austria, and you pride yourself on your democratic institutions, while you yourself consent to be the mere tools and bodyguards of the tyrants of Virginia and Carolina. You invite to your shores fugitives of oppression from abroad, honor them with banquets, greet them with ovations, cheer them, toast them, salute them, protect them, and pour out your money to them like water. But the fugitives from your own land, you advertise, hunt, arrest, shoot, and kill. Your glory in your refinement and your universal education, yet you maintain a system as barbarous and dreadful as it has ever stained the character of a nation, a system begun in avarice, supported in pride, perpetuated in cruelty. You shed tears over fallen Hungary and make the sad story of her wrongs the theme of your poets, statesmen, and orators, till your gallant sons are ready to fly to arms to vindicate her cause against the oppressor. But in regard to the 10,000 wrongs of the American slave, you would enforce the strictest silence and would hail him an enemy of the nation who dares to make those wrongs the subject of public discourse. You are all on fire at the mention of liberty for France or for Ireland, but are as cold as an iceberg at the thought of liberty for the enslaved of America. You discourse eloquently on the dignity of labor, yet you sustain a system which by its very essence casts a stigma upon labor. You can bare your bosom to the storm of British artillery to throw off a threepenny tax on tea, yet wring the last hard-earned farthing from the grasp of black laborers of your country. You profess to believe that of one blood God made all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth and hath commanded all men everywhere to love one another, yet you notoriously hate and glory in your hatred all men whose skins are not colored like your own. You declare before the world and are understood by the world to declare that you hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet you hold securely in a bondage which, according to your own Thomas Jefferson, is worse than the ages that which your fathers rose in rebellion to oppose, a seventh part of the inhabitants of your country. Fellow citizens, I will not enlarge further on your national inconsistencies. The existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism as a sham, your humanity as a base pretense, and your Christianity as a lie. It destroys your moral power abroad. It corrupts your politicians at home. It saps the foundation of religion. It makes your name a hissing and a byword to a mocking earth. It is the antagonistic force in your government, the only thing that seriously disturbs and endangers your union. It fetters your progress. It is the enemy of improvement, the deadly foe of education. It fosters pride. It breeds insolence. It promotes vice. It shelters crime. It is a curse to the earth, what supports it, and yet you cling to it as if it were the sheet anchor of all your hopes. Be warned. A horrible reptile is coiled up in your nation's bosom. The venomous creature is nursing at the tender breast of your youthful republic. For the love of God, tear away and fling from you the hideous monster, and let the weight of 20 millions crush and destroy it forever. But it is answered in reply to all of this that precisely what I have denounced is in fact guaranteed and sanctioned by the Constitution of the United States, that the right to hold and hunt slaves is a part of that Constitution framed by the illustrious fathers of this Republic. Then I dare to inform, notwithstanding all I have said before, your fathers, instead of being the honest men I have before declared them to be, were the veriest impostors that ever practiced on mankind. This is the inevitable conclusion, and from it there is no escape. but I differ from those who charge this baseness on the framers of the Constitution of the United States. It is a slander on their memory, at least so I believe, and others have, I think, fully and clearly vindicated the Constitution from any design to support slavery for an hour. Allow me to say in conclusion, notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. I therefore leave off where I began, with hope, while drawing encouragement from the Declaration of Independence, the great principles it contains, and the genius of American institutions. My spirit is cheered by the obvious tendencies of the age. Nations do not now stand in the same relation to each other that they did ages ago. No nation can now shut itself up from the surrounding world and trot around in the same old paths of its fathers without interference. The time was when such could be done, but a change has now come over the affairs of mankind. Walled cities and empires have become unfashionable. The arm of commerce has borne away the gates of the strong city. Intelligence is penetrating the darkest corners of the globe. Wind, steam, and lightning are its chartered agents. Oceans no longer divide, but link nations together. From Boston to London is now a holiday excursion. Space is comparatively annihilated. Thoughts expressed on one side of the Atlantic are distinctly heard on the others. In the fervent aspirations of William Lloyd Garrison, I say, let every heart join in saying it. All God speed the day when human blood shall cease to flow. In every clime be understood the claims of human brotherhood, and each return for evil good, not blow for blow. That day will come all feuds to end and change into a faithful friend each foe. Now, I'm going to have to say, it's tempting to look at things from back in history and say, oh, it's back then. This is all alive now. There's people hunting people, immigrants in this country. There's bounties for different kinds of people. The slave hunter still stalks the street and still hunts people. It's really important to never, ever think that this is over. The history of this country started from this, and don't dare listen to this speech by Frederick Douglass and think of it as the past. It's not. The history and what this was continues to the very present. I'll have other people speak on other subjects, so I'm not going to speak on them, but there's a lot to be said here. So, I'm going to move on. There may be more stuff I'll read.
Hello! We have a really great guest today. I have Coyote Woman, who will be speaking about the perspective of colonialism and this holiday from a mixed indigenous perspective. Coyote Woman, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Shodachi Kahe. Hello, greetings. I'll be going by the alias of Coyote Woman for today's talk. Today is a heavy subject. I am a decolonizing descendant of the Apsalaka Nation. I am the Two-Spirit Woman. For those who are visually impaired, you'll find a map on my face of traditional tattoos, as well as my histories of travel to different indigenous front lines and the freight train. I have brown hair. I am loving to my community and absolutely defiant to our oppressor, the settler colonial agency and business project known as the America. I am proudly self-defined as an anti-colonial wrecking agent. And today I have presentations of what 250 years of colonization here on occupied Turtle Island means. It is important as we go through this that indigenous peoples are not a monolith. There are even some of us, such as myself, who are displaced diaspora, who are decolonizing our ways and finding our truth. My grandfather is of the bloodline of the Children of the Longbeak Bird and Kicked in the Belly's clan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to have you here. You know, I know we are quite close around here, and I know this day pisses you off. And,
oh, so much.
And, you know, I am just letting you pop off today because what you're going to say is important, and it should be recorded so that other people can benefit or at least be annoyed by it.
Sure. Let's call it posterity for the next 7 generations of resistance.
Yeah, I've been reading an anarchist named Aragorn who wrote The Fight for Turtle Island, and this morning it's like Coyote Woman is always antagonistic, and I got a special understanding of the kind of antagonism towards colonialism that I see often from Coyote Woman.
Oh yeah, I often feel kindred to Aragorn. Brief hanging out one time, but never truly spent enough time with him. I can tell you, a man after my own heart, and when it comes to anti-colonial attack against the adversary. Our attacks can be found within education, within skill sharing, within decolonizing our brain, as many of us that carry indigenous histories, as we are decolonizing, it's suggested that our comrades and accomplices and ally who happen to be settler descent, mind you, settler descent is not the enemy. The colonizer is. But here we'll be discussing ways to activate the mind, understand what the America has been doing for 250 years and what it continues to do on these lands. Our genocide was not completed, but it is still ongoing.
Well, we can see the colonizer today. Can you, for the people who don't really see the military occupation that we are all living under, can you identify some of the agents that we are seeing around of colonization?
Absolutely. One biggest signifier that we could all see manifest in its ways of typical brown shirt Gestapo tactics of kidnappers known as ICE agents. Right now, as we speak, ICE agents also raid Apache and Tohono O'odham lands. These are ongoing threats. As we're considering immigrant rights and migration rights, you know, we have to also consider how it plays effect for the Indian Removal Act, and we could get into that more.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Indian Removal Act?
Oh, yeah. Well, first, to understand the Indian Removal Act, one has to understand that the America was a business opportunity. We are looking at 250 years ago where the America was founded on insular North America, along with its corporate and cahoots ally known as Canada.
Well, we can, you know, it was a business opportunity, this country, and people talk about reforming America, and and people have to see that from the very beginning this was meant to be property of the most wealthy, and the indigenous people were just in the way.
Just simply in the way. And that's the reality of it, too. In its earliest conquest, you know, like the continued conquest. Mind you, this is continuing. There is no such thing as pre-colonial and post-colonial. As long as these colonial systems are in place, we recognize as anti-colonial wrecking agents that we are still under colonial occupation. These things are still in effect. On the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, this is really important to note, that the aggressive language of merciless Indian savage is still in print today, has not changed for 250 years. Their colonial tactic manual of the Independence Declaration of Independence was a direct ripoff of Haudenosaunee teachings. Again, we are not a monolith. Coming from Apsalaka Nation, which is in so-called Montana Agency, and being a descendant of Haudenosaunee, over on these sides, closer to occupied Indakina, so-called Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, all these places, this is Indakina. Many of us anti-colonials will see a map in a very different light. The unlearning of what state line is, of what federal agency is, the unlearning of these authorities and powers over our lives. We believe that we are autonomous. So to exercise these autonomous sovereign muscles, when we are hitting this anniversary, we certainly have to consider who is involved at sitting at the table for the next 250 years. This business plan, getting back to the point of business plan, there were Dutch settlers. These were businessmen. They were not displaced in the means that history would like us to believe. They understood that there is a new world rich in resources. We can fast forward to these times and see how resource extraction is still in effect according to this 100-year business plan. Every 100 years, they come up with a new business plan. Therefore, we have to come up with another 7 generations of protection. When the Dutch arrived, one has to consider that they came from towns, infrastructure, manure piles, cattle, crops, infrastructure, irrigation, and towns. These are people far removed from living harmoniously with life ways. The tribes of Europe had forgotten their ways through colonization of their own lands. Now, new infrastructures have been put in place. When they heard of a business plan and pressures from old world were happening, they came over here. Yes, they were undesirable and unwanted where they came from. But as they came over here and hit Plymouth, many of these Puritans, many of these people came starving. These are people who are used to crops, cattle, getting their certain means, not from hunting and gathering. They came here, they saw resource extraction. Those resources was new fertile grounds to grow their crops, to implement their ways of settler colonialism, and ultimately destroy the land and the food source. I often like to think of Sun Tzu or Lao Tzu. These people had excellent critiques of the art of war, sieging food supply and altering the terrain is a war tactic to starve out the people. But we could see these things in effect in many ways today. Today, I'm fucking pissed off. I don't know if I could cuss on here, but I'm pissed off at the colonial occupation on these lands that manifested in different ways.
Yeah, you can cuss all you want, but try not to say my name, because I'll have to edit it out.
Oh. Roger that.
Yeah. But so, we've got people coming here for a business plan. How much has things changed since they landed in Jamestown and in Plymouth? How much have things changed?
Well, I can say their tactics, their technology, their way of being has changed. These benefactors of the colonial project and opportunists. But the mentality has not changed. Since day one, indigenous peoples on these lands have been considered a liability and in the way for their project. We can find this on oil pipelines and mining corporations today for precious minerals such as lithium, crude oil, tar sands, uranium, and what has you. These business opportunists, go on sovereign indigenous land. This is a whole other can of worms to open up. Talking about treaties. Treaties, we have to acknowledge, that were signed not out of opportunity, but out of desperation. The conqueror's gunpoint at their head. The starvation. The pushing to the brink, to in desperation, to the point of desperation, to the where they sign land over. In settler colonialism, there is this idea coming from feudal empires that one could own land, be a lord of your own castle. This mentality was not the case and was not even introduced into the indigenous lens or zeitgeist of conversation. Owning land, it was not such a thing. Having heritage lands had nuance to it, where great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers hunted for millennia. Another consideration to have is these indigenous lifeways have been around for millennia before just the mere 250 years of these kids calling it America these days. And in my unlearning, I'm seeing more and more of how my adversary develops.
How have they developed? And what are you seeing recently?
More lies. More false trust. There's also blatant fascism. Here's that word again, manifested out of settler colonialism. What we see today is this fence walking with the ally, and the outright hate and warmongering of the far right. We also have to consider that a left and right system was born from Europe, and it's a horseshoe concept. Many of us have heard about the horseshoe concept. Where do you lean? Leftist, centric, far right? Where are we on that political horseshoe? We have to understand that that horseshoe was made for a colonial, settler colonial horse. It was not made for these lands. It is an invasion, it is an interloper, and this blatant idea that we have to trust, we have to reform, we have to make America better, and that's a narrative that's both on the left and the far right. Make America great on the far right. And on the other hand, there's the reform that we have to fix America. America can't be fixed. It's doing exactly what it's intended to do. We can find this in the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Not one indigenous representative signed these documents. There was not one native signature. So considering that, we know that it's an invasion. Another thing that is a blatant, baffling, double standard is the fact that when we talk about broken treaties overseas, it is a war crime, and it is reason to strike battle with each other. Why is that not the narrative here? I'll leave that to the audience to consider, to toy with. I encourage you to not listen to this as an academia, not to listen to this as some sort of settler ally training, but for an intense decolonization of what we are responsible for. The America is doing exactly what it's doing, and I gotta say, it's our fault. We have to take responsibility.
I've always thought about vigilance, and to talk about responsibility, my crew was partially helped get knocked down Richard Spencer, but we missed one of Spencer's schoolmates, Stephen Miller, and I still feel shame about that, because one of my comrades, who was from indigenous person from Colombia, knew about Stephen Miller when he was still in high school, and we were not He wasn't even on our radar. And this monster is now the one designing the immigration hell that we're seeing. Not that someone else wouldn't do it, but we missed. That is our responsibility, if you call yourself an anti-fascist, is to be vigilant. And that's...
Absolutely.
I mean, that's where we failed, is by not seeing him. What can you say about that?
Well, I think it's important that though there was a failure, this is a critique of what we can do in the future. You know, to build our cabins on the cliffs of sorrows and regret of what could have, should have, would have happened. We can be thankful for the opportunity of knowing what to do next. Another gentle critique, my dear comrade, my sibling in arms, I want to talk a bit about leftist and what that means. Going back to the horseshoe, this is derived from Europe. It is an important tool to understand where we reside in our politics and or anti-politics. However, me personally, I don't define myself as leftist, though many of my comrades can translate me as such. The reason being, left and right came from the tensions of Europe. As an indigenous anarchist and growing in my decolonization walk, I understand that that is a lens that often, unfortunately, in our own communities of anti-fascism, still upholds a left and right system on these territories, and again, indigenous peoples are left out of the narrative so often. When we consider revolution and reform, a brother in arms, a teacher, a comrade, may he rise in power, Cli Benale, once told me that revolution is to tear down a system and replace it with another. I encourage comrades to start asking questions with our land defenders, our water protectors, our sovereignty fighters. You know, these people, what do they want on their own lands? Because as you're tearing down a system to replace it with a new one, is it Eurocentric in nature? Have you asked the question of what Turtle Island means? And if you don't know what Turtle Island is, you're standing on it. The United Snakes of America and its counterpart, Canada, has been a colonial project with no permission on these territories. That is a fact. That is a historical fact. It's not a political opinion. It is just fact. So we have to be asking the questions as we are stirring up good trouble, and you're putting up the good fight, and you're educating yourself, you're decolonizing your mind, you're understanding anti-fascism and our responsibility to keep our streets clean from Nazis. One has to understand, what are you doing on sovereign territory? I stand firmly both feet currently on occupied Indochina. This is not Vermont. To me, this is Indochina, and it stretches from here all the way up to so-called Labrador in Canada. Why are we not having these questions of what state authorities, state lines are, and what do indigenous peoples of Indochina, so-called Vermont and other spaces nearby, what do they require of us as we uphold their sovereignty?
To rewind a little bit,
sure.
We were having a conversation this morning, Coyote Woman and I, we were talking, and she talked about indigenous communism. But the thing is, that's how people are supposed to live. Humans are social, yes, cooperative animals.
Yes.
We don't need a particular ideology to just live as humans. It's not natural to have to just hold everything to yourself in almost any traditional society. A person who is a miser, they stay in their house or and they're not part of the community. And that is, that aberrant behavior has been normalized in so many places, and it is not, you don't have to have Marxism to know that. This is not the nature of the human being. We don't, if it was, we could, it wouldn't be suffering to be held in a cell alone. You would just be alone.
Absolutely. That's another thing. Communism, I'm glad you brought this up. So communism and much of anarchisms, we can see this with legends of their own right. I'm glad that they were around. I don't identify as communist, and I stray from certain extreme tanky Leninist organizing. However, I can tell you that these Euro scholars, philosophers, political theorists, these greats, they studied indigenous lifeways. They observed them. They even cited much of it. To be community, I do know in my pan-indigenous eclecticism on my decolonizing path of the Red Road that I walk, and learning to walk better in, I do know that our Dene relatives in the southwest of so-called Four Corners, of so-called Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, this region right here of Dene Bekea, Dene Ta, they speak of Ke. I cannot open up completely on this as it's not my culture and not my ways. What I give to you is an echo of others that have took the time to tell me. Ke is a integral responsibility, and my Dene isn't the best, but it's Ke. And it's an integral responsibility, kinship and clanship to your neighbor. This is just how it is. We see this develop in the politics of, you know, the chapter houses, you know, like 505 region or zone can have a meeting with the neighboring region zone in a chapter house to discuss mineral rights, water rights, ongoing uranium mining problem that nobody had permission to do. You know, the communism that's been coined as communism, this is just an ancient truth that has existed for millennia. But that is why I'm an indigenous anarchist and tribal anarchist, understanding these truths in a decolonizing path.
Yeah, I mean, to switch gears a little bit, you look at, I've spent time with farm workers from Oaxaca and from, mm-hmm. and some less with people from Chiapas. Mm-hmm. And as far as anarchism, they see things as they are, and if it's bullshit, they call it. And anarchists oppose authority that is unjust. I'm to paraphrase something I've seen elsewhere. It's not my stuff, but you know, indigenous anarchists would look for the relations and oppose, and instead put responsibility. I think that was. On the Indigenous Action podcast, and that sort of stuck with me. Mm-hmm. The difference mm-hmm. between, you know, a European anarchist and the more indigenous perspective. And this is just me grasping at something I don't fully hold, but, you know, it's like, it's, again, it is human to see bullshit and call it out. And that's the basis of anarchism as I know it, the best of anarchism.
Sure.
Not the theory. The anarchism from the gut and from the chest.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a spiritual responsibility. So, like, my relationship with anarchism, I'm so glad that you brought this up. And sovereignty is going to come up again, too. I often defend others' sovereignty. I know nothing of what Crow Agency's sovereignty is because I have been robbed from those bloodlines due to boarding schools. But here we go. My relationship with anarchisms, anarchism as a tension to the politics versus it being a politic, behaving and relating in these different ways, to understand that this is a tool in understanding, a method, a walk of life to attack, you know, these fascistic structures of power that marginalize, that destroy, that are xenophobic by nature. Our vigilance is a spiritual thing. Academia could only go so far without practice. Likewise, sovereignty. Everybody's sovereignty looks different on these lands. On this 250-year anniversary, there's much sovereignty of various indigenous nations who's not considered. That sovereignty is to be respected in the relationship of the seven generations, what our comrade here is talking about, that responsibility in our communities. Many times we hold circles of accountability, and I know personally I have had to sit for hours, you know, sometimes a couple days in some of our frontline encampments where we're having accountability circles because we have a responsibility to the seventh generation. You know, it kind of hits a little different when an ongoing genocide is happening. You then step into responsibility as opposed to a politic. You know you have to make this work or you're dead. Example, there are 13,000 Crow on census. I'm sure there's more, but on census. Because I know that there's a lot of rebels out there that are just like, I don't want to be on no goddamn American census, you know? So, like, I appreciate that. But what we got recorded on U.S. census is 13,000. To put that more clearly, there are 45,000 Euro settlers, aka whites, in Burlington, Vermont alone. This is a stark difference in numbers. A whole town that dwarfs a whole nation. This continued genocide. When we're sitting on this anniversary, we have to consider, are we asking for a reform of America? Or do we want to destroy its structures of power altogether? Another parallel I'd like to draw, though I don't know what the shoes of a Palestinian would be, I would never pretend to, but one thing we have in common is a settler colonial system of oppression that is continuing to genocide. Would we be asking for a reformed Israel? Or would we want a free Palestine altogether? These questions I ask of these territories, this land called Turtle Island. These occupied territories reach from the Arctic Circle way up north in so-called Canada all the way down to the tip of Patagonia in so-called Chile and Argentina, all in the Caribbean. These are the indigenous territories that was infected by this America, this business project.
Yeah. So this is what is being celebrated today.
Genocide.
Yeah.
Xenophobia. Slavery. More oppressive systems. Masked goons. Gestapo thugs that are kidnapping people, whether they're citizen or not. Just because they pass birthright citizen in office, don't be duped. They will still come, they will still act, and they will still pacify the masses, thinking that you are upholding American rights and you are safe. Keep others in mind. There is a marginalization scale. It's also important to define how America, during the 1500s and 1600s, the first colonies, and the European aristocrats, how they formed what we know as whiteness today. Let's pick this apart. Can we? Would that be okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. Might want to take do this on a different track, though.
Okay, yeah, this is going to be a long one, guys. This might be a couple sections, because let me tell you, 250 years of this bullshit has got me driven, like, up a wall. You know, I just want to go count coup on them. I fucking hate it.
I'm gonna stop the recording for a moment,
okay,
and then we'll bring it in another track.
Later, guys. Jorge.
And I expect this conversation will be carried on to another episode, as we only got started on the subjects. I apologize about the sound quality. We did this on the 4th to be posted on the 4th, so it was a little rushed. There was some sound clipping, but I hope you can forgive. It's an important subject. If you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. And if this pissed you off, talk about it. Spread it and complain. Not going to talk about reviews, but you can if you want. This was VMN Volume 5, Episode 3. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. It's kind of gross that this podcast is named after an invader state, but the history was to take the name from a schmuck who has million-dollar houses after being a supposed socialist. Whatever.